Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is Joe Donovan, and welcome to the Daughters and Sons Hour, a weekly conversation addressing issues and concerns for daughters and sons of parents with mental illness. Tonight, our guest is Linda Gray Sexton, the author of the book Searching for Mercy Street, Half in Love, and Be Spotted, and I'm bringing her on the air right about now. Hello, Linda, are you on the air?
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, is this Joe?
Yes, it is.
Oh, good. I was getting calls, but I couldn't hear anybody on the other end.
Yeah, that's the nature of this thing.
Okay, well, that's okay as long as we're connected now. Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I'm just playing with...
No problem.
The computer stuff here.
Okay.
So I want to start off just to discuss your three memoirs. And for me, you know, one of the things that I would think of... when scheduling this was that, you know, a few months ago on Facebook, there was a handful of folks who were listing 10 books that influenced their lives. And for me, Search for Mercy Street was one of those books, just because of the way you talk about your childhood and your mother and that relationship. And I guess might as well just start off with you sharing a little bit about that for those who may or may not know who your mother was and some of the dynamics in your relationship.
Sure. Well, my mother was a Pulitzer Prize winning poet. She won the Pulitzer in 1967. So I grew up in the home of a writer, which was a pretty amazing experience. She was also very mentally ill, very depressed, and suicidal. And this had an enormous impact on our family, you know, to grow up as the daughter of someone who tries repeatedly to kill herself is a very difficult position to be in. It's a very traumatic experience. And as a child, you know, I had a lot to deal with, and so did my sister. So... my mother died when I was 21, and I was her literary executor, so I went through a lot of dealing with her suicide through taking care of her work after she was gone. And when I got to be about 40 and had a family of my own, two sons, I began to think hard about my own childhood and how difficult it must have been for my mom to be a parent, that what I previously thought was so easy was turning out to be remarkably hard. Raising kids is not a piece of cake. And I began to have more respect for the way in which she had struggled to be a good parent, even though ultimately she was not a good parent. The book is largely an examination of how we come to forgive people who let us down. And my mother, you know, had let the whole family down in many ways. She had scarred us. But I was able to go back in retrospect and see from my own perspective as a parent and as an adult better, and through my own bouts with depression, I was able to understand better what she had gone through and really go through a process of forgiveness. So Searching for Mercy Street is about a journey of learning to forgive a parent for their shortcomings.
Okay. One of the aspects of the book that really resonated with me, I thought, was the way you focused on kind of different periods in your childhood, you know, so you referred to like Linda when she was 10 years old, or when she was 16, when she was 21, and how each one was really just kind of a different individual, and each had a very different relationship with the mother at that time, which for me was, I think, really eye-opening, because I struggled prior to reading that about, you know, how do I define and understand my relationship with my parents, because the person who I was when I was younger is not the person who I am now. I guess my thing is, how did you come up with the idea of kind of developing it that way, or was it something that you thought through about identifying a period of time like that?
It's an interesting question. You know, writing this kind of book, so much goes on an unconscious level in terms of how you're going to develop it. I did not, in contrast with my fiction, I did not write an outline. I simply found one day a voice talking inside my head, and I started to write things down. And it just sort of spilled out of me in the form that it originally took. A lot of rewriting went on, but structurally, which is what you're talking about, you know, how did I structure it so that I was a child here, an adult here, and how did I structure the book in that manner? That was sort of an intuitive, unconscious process where I just followed along what was happening inside my head, because the book really isn't chronological, it's thematic. And, you know, I examine different perspectives about what's going on, and it does have relationship to what age I was at the time that those things present themselves, but it's not told from the point of view of Linda at 3, Linda at 6, Linda at 10, Linda at 12, Linda at 16. It moves in and out and weaves itself through not only my life in my chronology, but also the chronology of my mother's life. So the two things kind of tie together and weave an interesting knot of viewpoint, time frame, different perspectives. And like I say, it was largely an unconscious process where the book unfolded in front of me. And that doesn't always happen. You know, with Half in Love, which is my second memoir, which I know we'll get to, but with that book, I labored long and hard over the structure. It was much more difficult. The book took me 10 years to write. Searching for Mercy Street took me closer to 2. The third memoir took me a year. So, you know, each book has its own rhythm, and you have to follow that rhythm to find the heart of the book.
Okay. The other thing for me that, even before I'd finished reading Search for Mercy Street, I realized I wanted to learn more, so I ran out and grabbed the collection of your mother's letters that you did. And read that right after, and I was fascinated, particularly because of the fact you were able to show events, experiences, really from two different perspectives, your perspective from Search for Mercy Street, then your mom's perspective from the different letters at the different periods of time. Was that, and I'm guessing that, you know, by compiling your letters also really influenced the writing of Searching for Mercy Street. Am I correct?
Well, in some ways, but you know, there's a huge time gap between the two things. I did the letters right after graduating from college in 75, and Searching for Mercy Street was 1994. So huge, what is that, 30, close to 30 years? 25 anyway, my math isn't very good, but the letters were written at a time in my life where I was really gliding on the downward plane of my mother's suicide. You know, it was begun the year following her death, and I was very alone in working on it. It was a huge project for somebody my age. I was only 21. To tackle, and I had to read through the entire archive of, you know, hundreds of thousands of pieces of paper, looking at everything there was, letters, manuscripts, tape recordings, transcripts, all sorts of things, and then decide which letters would be best representative of a period in her life. So there I was really working as Linda the daughter, trying to recreate a tale of her mother's life, and I was in a place where I wasn't grappling with my own demons at all. I was much more absorbed in telling her story, and I wanted it to be, you know, as witty as she could be, as funny as she could be, her sense of humor I wanted to capture, the sadness in her story, her emotional ups and downs. So there was this whole constellation of characteristics about Anne Sexton that I wanted to cover and to portray fully, so that people got a sense of the whole woman. And that's why, you know, your listeners probably don't know, the Book of Letters is constructed so the letters run with little narrative pieces in between them, so it really tells the story of her life like a biography in letters, which is why the subtitle of the book is A Self-Portrait in Letters. So she's really telling her own story, and I'm helping the story along by setting the letters into context. When I wrote Searching for Mercy Street, it was so many years later that I don't know that the letters had informed me about her life. I understood her life. I had worked with Diane Middlebrook on the very complicated biography that came out before I wrote Searching for Mercy Street, and I had a real fully developed perspective on her life. And Searching for Mercy Street was an examination of the way our lives intersected. So it was sort of like a next step because I was drawing myself into the picture. I don't think at the time I was writing Searching for Mercy Street that I really thought so much about the letters. The letters were like part of the library of my mother that I read about and drew upon over the years, but they weren't right there in the forefront of my mind as I was writing Searching for Mercy Street, because I was at a totally different place in my life. I had, you know, really become an adult. And when I was 21, that's just the tail end of adolescence. And she had just died. I had no perspective on her death at all. By the time I got to Searching for Mercy Street, I had a lot of perspective. So, and my feelings about it were very different, about her death were very different. So the two things are related, but in a kind of funny way, not so directly as I think your question kind of implies.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's just one of those things that, for me, I thought it was really
You, because you were reading them back to back,
right.
So you could see relationships between them that I probably can't even see today. If you and I sat and just talked about what you saw in the Book of Letters versus what you saw in Searching for Mercy Street, it would probably be very interesting for me, because you would see all sorts of parallels and differences that I just don't perceive all that well, because they were written at such two different points in my life.
Okay, well, so I guess the next thing is to start taking a look at the second book now, Half in Love. And in this case, you know, you're moving on, and now this is where you start to focus on yourself as a mother, a wife, and struggles in your adulthood. So how would you go, so what can you share about kind of the why and hows and what for getting started with that?
Well, you know, when I finished Searching for Mercy Street, I was feeling very strong in my life. I felt I was in touch with my inner woman, to use an old cliche. I felt I had control over previous depressions. I was kind of on a high. And then I turned 45, which was the same year in my mother's life that she had killed herself. So I kind of arrived at this jumping off point. She was 45 when she died. Now I was 45. I had always identified with her to the extreme. So what was going to happen to me now? My mother's life ended, and where did my life go now? And I got incredibly depressed. I just went through a period of ghastly, ghastly bipolar depression. I was newly diagnosed with bipolar disorder and would fluctuate between mania and depression, but mostly I had depression. And I started thinking of suicide more and more, as much as I hated myself for that, because, you know, my mother had made such a terrible impact on our lives with suicide that I thought, if I were to think of this, what did it mean to my children? And that was a terrible, terrible thing to think. You know, it was demoralizing, but it was traumatic in and of itself. I didn't want to hurt my children. It was my main priority not to hurt them as I had once been hurt. But the depression became so intense that I saw no way out, and I did try to kill myself three times. So somewhere in the middle of that, I heard another little voice in my head. And for me, books always start with little voices in the head. I don't mean sick voices. I mean productive, creative voices. And I started writing down what I was feeling and what was happening to me, even though I really couldn't work. I couldn't go into my writing room. I couldn't sit in front of the computer. I stayed in bed almost all day unless I had to take my kids to school or after-school activities or cook them dinner. I was pretty housebound. And I couldn't work, but I found that I could write down feelings. So I started writing down what I was feeling, and little by little, as the years passed and I started to get better again, I found that it was growing into a book. And the book this time was not an examination of my mother's life. It was more an examination of my mother's death and the feelings I had about that as an adult, and how that impacted me. The subtitle of the book is Surviving the Legacy of Suicide. And I felt that throughout my family, suicide had been handed on as a legacy to my mother, from family members in generations before her. There was a lot of mental illness. And then on to me from my mother. And I was, of course, terrified that I would then pass it on to my kids. And, of course, we know that bipolar disorder is a heritable disease. So, you know, there were a lot of things working in my mind. The only thing I knew how to do was to write about it. So as I got better, I was able to pull myself together and start writing again. And I had a lot of disorganized material that spanned back over 3 or 4 years. And I started trying to pull it together, and it was repetitive, and it wasn't very good. So I ended up scrapping a lot of it, but it did give me a basis for a beginning. And so I started on Half in Love. It took 10 years to write. And it was an examination of my own suicidal tendencies, as mirrored as my mother's were a backdrop in this book against my own suicidal tendencies. That's how I should put it. And, you know, I worked my way through to a healthy place, and the book has a very upbeat ending because I return to health again. I remarry. My kids go on to be young adults who, you know, lead productive lives. And so that's basically how the second memoir occurred and what the second memoir is about.
Okay. That actually answered a couple of my questions. you know,
okay, I talked a long time, so that's good.
Yeah, because my next issue was about the whole area about identity formation, which is very common among people who have a parent with mental illnesses. That's how do you separate yourself from your parent? And, you know, and again, that's where you just pointed out was the struggle once you hit 45 and trying to really define yourself differently, and you struggled with that.
Yeah. When you have a parent who ends their life and you've identified heavily with that parent, they end, then what's supposed to happen to you? How do you go on? Do you go on in the way they went on, the many of the ways you identified with, or do you create something new for yourself? And it took me a long time to create something new for myself. I almost died doing it. But the fact is I did do it, and that, you know, took me to wonderful new places where I was able to write the third memoir, which is a total departure in terms of, I like to think of these three books as a trilogy. And the first part, Searching for Mercy Street, is about dealing with my mother's life and learning to forgive. And Half in Love is about dealing with her death and dealing with my own death wishes and learning to forgive myself. And Bespotted is a book about remembering. It's the third part of the trilogy, and it's going back into childhood and remembering the joyous things. So instead of talking about the dark, I'm talking about the light.
Well, let's move on to that. You know, Bespotted is basically a new approach because it's, you know, about the dogs in your life and how they've been with you during the bad and the good times, I guess. But, you know, let's talk about examples, if you have.
Sure. Well, as I say, it was a departure for me because searching for Mercy Street and Half in Love do have moments of joy. But by and large, the thrust is an examination of the darker elements of my life. And as I came out of that period that Half in Love defined and found myself finally in a healthy spot, I was really able to go back into looking at the joyous aspects of my life from childhood through to adulthood. And I realized that many of my main happy memories had to do with the family's interaction with our Dalmatians, our dogs. And it sounds a little funny, of course, to say, well, I talked about this from the keyhole watching our family with the dogs. But in fact, you know, the dogs were therapy dogs for us in those early years. For my mother in particular, they buoyed her mood. She won the Pulitzer for a book called Live or Die. The centerpiece of that book was a poem called Live, which was about a sudden joyous discovery that life was within her as well as death. And that poem was created around the birth of a litter of puppies that we had. We all sat and watched the puppies being born, and she was so moved that she went upstairs and wrote this incredible poem, and I think all of us felt that the puppies had really cheated death. She turned a corner. She became healthier. She was able to find joy in life again. That didn't last for forever, but the dogs that came from the litter, the dogs that came into our lives afterwards, all provided her with a sense of buoyancy is the word I like to use. And therefore, the dogs were therapy dogs for us as well. As an adult, there was a period in my life where I had no dogs and was miserable without dogs because I didn't live in places where you could have dogs. But as I got to be an adult, I craved having another dog. Just the joy they bring into your life, the humor, the way they stick with you every day, no matter where you go, room to room, couch to couch, desk to desk, they are there. And I began to really want to bring a dog into the lives of my children as well. So we got a series of Dalmatians, and when I got very, very depressed in my late 40s, there was one particular dog whom I had at that time, and he was just a magical dog. He lay with me on the bed when I couldn't get out of bed and kissed away every tear I cried. He comforted me. He accepted me. Even though I felt like a disgusting, depressed human being, he accepted me for who I was and loved me anyway. When all the people in my life basically walked out and said, "We can't deal with you," he was there. And so I saw again through my own life how a dog could truly be a therapy dog, how dogs stick with you through thick and thin and really can change your life in some ways. So that was that period, and then I became very interested in breeding and in showing the dogs. I had showed horses when I was growing up, and that brought me a great deal of pleasure, and I talk about that in Bespotted. And then as an adult, I decided to show the dogs, and that led kind of naturally to breeding the dogs and re-experiencing that miraculous feeling we had all had that snowy winter morning when the puppies had been born during my childhood and my mother took a turn for the better. So the dogs really have been a pivotal point in my life, and I wanted to write about something positive for once. I kind of had explored everything I had to say about the difficult things, and I wanted to write about, you know, something that had brought every member of my family great joy, and that I know, I mean, there are 80 million dogs in American households today. People need dogs, love dogs, and are empowered by dogs. So, you know, I knew that there were other people this book would speak to, just the way Searching for Mercy Street spoke to you, just the way Half in Love spoke to others. You know, I knew there was an audience of people who would respond. And I've always been very fortunate that people write to me and tell me not only what they think of my books, but how moved they've been, how it has made a difference in their lives in terms of their perspective with their parents, with their children, on their own lives, you know, whatever. I've been very fortunate those people write to me and communicate with me. It makes me feel like, gee, you know, writing is really worth it. I'm reaching someone. And despite the difficulties, despite how bleak it is in the publishing world these days, if you reach even one or two people in a day, you know you're doing well. So that's kind of the story with Bespotted.
Okay. Take a minute here and see if there's anyone who's out there who'd like to call in. For the number to call is 646-564-9555. 646-564-9557. I guess the next thing is what now? You're working on a new book?
Yes, I am. I'm working on a novel. I'm going back to my roots. I started out after the Book of Letters as a novelist. Wrote four, published four novels, and then went to memoir. And I think I have had up, you know, for right now anyway, enough to say about myself, and I wanted to create something imaginative. So I began a novel back last spring. Had to take a break when Bespotted came out because there was a lot of publicity work to be done, and I write a newsletter weekly that goes out to, you know, a raft of people, and I have to work on that as well. So there was a lot of stuff, publication time, which I had to take care of. So I took a break and went back to it in December. So I actually had a six-month break, which is a very long time. But the great thing about this book is Justice was searching for Mercy Street and would be spotted, it's just kind of pouring out of me. I'm having a wonderful time with the characters. I've got a voice talking in my head, and I am just charging right along. I think that writing the newsletters, which you can sign up for on my website, really stimulated me in a particular kind of way, because each one is like a little mini essay. It's not a newsletter like a news bulletin or anything. It's an essay on a topic, whatever happens to strike me as the best one. Some of them are about my dog. Some of them are about my writing life. Some of them are about life in general. The holidays provoked a lot of feelings for me that I wrote about, the new year. So that newsletter really gave me, it was like exercising a muscle, and the muscle got very strong. So when I got back to the novel, you know, in the last month I've written 100 pages, which is just huge for me. I never write that quickly. So I'm really having a good time with this. It's, you know, I won't say it's fun. Writing is a lot of work, and it's solitary work. You know, you're on your own. There's nobody there to say, you know, what are you up to? How much have you produced? Nothing really, nobody but yourself. So you have to be very self-disciplined. And I try to make myself sit down at the same time every day and do a certain number of hours of work, even if it's, as I say, with Half in Love, I wrote a lot of bad stuff that I end up throwing away. Even if you end up throwing it away, at least you make the effort. And that's my perspective on writing, is to just sit down and do something, even if it's not very good. You can always revise it. You can always throw it out. You can always make it better. You can always start afresh. But in any case, you have to do something, because if you don't do something every day, you procrastinate forever. And I get a lot of questions from people about, you know, my writing process, and they want to write something. And my best advice is always sit down and write. So, yeah, that's what I'm doing now as a novel.
Okay. I guess the next question that just popped in my head was, obviously, as you mentioned earlier, you've had a lot of response from various people about the different books. Is there anything memorable, from someone who's read something that when they shared their perspective, validated what you were trying to accomplish with that book or something like to that effect?
Yeah, actually, there was one woman who began to write to me after I published Half in Love, excuse me, and she was someone who was mentally ill. And that book elicited a lot of correspondence from people who had bipolar disorder, who were schizophrenic, you know, a lot of people who were troubled, who needed somebody to talk to, who read the book and found it spoke for them. And that's what that whole book was about, was giving a voice to people who could not speak for themselves. And the mentally ill very often cannot speak for themselves. So I liked to feel at least that that book gave them a voice. So anyway, there was a woman who wrote to me who was quite troubled. And she wrote me an absolutely beautiful letter about how much the book had meant to her in her illness. And she said, and she was a great admirer of my mother's poetry. I also get a lot of people writing to me about my mother's poetry. And she said that she was a great admirer of mother's poetry, but that mother's poetry had always taken her closer to the edge of suicide, and that Half in Love had pulled her back. And that was very moving to me. I've never forgotten it. I took the letter and hung it on the wall in my office. So, you know, when you get a strong response like that and you know you've really helped someone in their struggle, it's a very moving, empowering feeling. It makes you feel like you should keep on writing, that you are reaching people. You may not be selling billions of books. You may not be on the bestseller list, but if you touch even a few people's lives, it's really, it's so important to me as a person.
and as a writer.
Yeah, because and that's kind of, Happy Love also really spoke to me, too, in the fact that, my mother has schizophrenia, and I, as an adult, have developed bipolar disorder as well. So the whole issue of, being a second generation and mental illness and kind of the difficulty of having to accept something that you had earlier in your life said, well, that will never be me, kind of thing. Which I you did explore some in that book. Could you share a little bit more about that?
I did explore it because it came to me as a shock that I could be like her that way. You know, I vowed my whole life long I'll never be like her. I'll never be depressed in that way that takes me to the edge and makes me want to jump off. And I discovered that I was like her that way. I was able to get well again. But, you know, we have so many advantages now that she never had. We've got medication and all sorts of different kinds of therapy, different sorts of therapists. She had a very strict Freudian analyst who largely let silence reign. Then she had another therapist who had a sexual relationship with her, which was a total abuse of his power. She had a really hard row to hoe, not just in terms of there being the medications available were just terrible medications. You could either be sedated or you could be crazy, but there was nothing in between. And for her to be sedated was very hard because then she couldn't work. She found it made her brain kind of confused and not operating, at full power. So she wasn't able to write if she took a lot of these medications. And without the medications, she was crazy. So I was fortunate in that, in the early part of the century, we had, in the late 90s and then early 2000s, we have all kinds of medication now, which treat bipolar disorder, depression, schizophrenia, all sorts of things. And if you have a good psychopharmacologist who works really hard with you, you can, find a cocktail sometimes of drugs which work really well for you and lift you up out of your depression or your mania, whatever it may be, coupled with therapy. But I'm, a lot of people say drugs, 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 and I'm like, look, if you've ever been in a position where all you want to do is die and you work really hard with somebody to find an appropriate level, an appropriate combination of different medications, and it relieves your pain, how can anybody argue with that? How can anybody argue with that?
Yeah, and that's something I've noticed too, that definitely with the way mental health illness is treated now versus 10, 20, 50 years ago, there's so many dramatic changes and so many dramatic differences and options that people have.
Yes, and public perception as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and to be able to understand what's there and to even learn about what's going on.
And I think too, there's been some improvement. I think things are still largely misunderstood. People are blamed for being depressed. Pick yourself up, shake yourself off, let's get going kind of thing is a response you often get, and my own family was that way, when in fact that doesn't help you at all because it's really not a question of just picking yourself up. It's a question of clawing your way back, and that takes a lot of strength and it takes time. So I do think, however, that public perception has gotten better. We talk more about this more openly. Mental illness is not as hidden as it once was. People came forward when I did Half in Love, when I would speak about it and talk about themselves and their families and how hard things were when you have a depressed or suicidal person in the family, or how hard it is to be suicidal and depressed. And I just think people are more open about it now, so that we have a better dialogue between the people who are affected, either families or patients, and the world in general, the world at large. So I think there's been a significant shift. Maybe not enough of a shift. I think there's still a lot people have to learn and accept. But by and large, there's, you know, a new awareness. That's how I put it.
I'm drawing a blank. Is there a question I haven't asked that I need to be asking? Books about life in general, because again, definitely with the earlier books, there is a lot of the really darker period, and it's really great to hear how you've reached this positive place right now. I think is the real trick, and which is going to lead me into my next question. For a lot of people, especially those who grew up with a parent with mental illness, there is kind of this sense of that they're going to be destined to live really terrible, horrendous lives because of the trauma, the experience, and many do have a lot of difficult times. But again, the whole issue of but there's are those good times, which kind of that hope that things get better. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Mental illness is a disease of hopelessness. You know, you feel you never will get well. If you have a parent who is mentally ill and you become depressed or bipolar or whatever, you know, your worst fear is really recognized, and it comes to pass that you too must deal with this in your life. I think if you have a parent who suicides, then you have no good role model to follow. You know, the trail ends, boom, there, and there's nowhere to go. So you have to create a new life for yourself. You have to really be able to live past that. If you had an identification with the parent whom you lose. I mean, I look at my sister, and she had a totally different experience, and she grew up in the same household. So, it doesn't have to be that growing up with a mentally ill parent means you're going to be suicidal or you're going to have a depressive disorder. But I don't know what the statistics are, but I'm certain that you have a much greater chance because all this stuff is heritable. So, I think the important thing to keep in mind is that people do get well. And that's one of the things I like to say to people when they come to me with, their troubled minds. I like to say, I got well, you can too. I did this. You can do it too, because I was at the bottom of the bottom of the bottom, and I came from the bottom. I lost my parent, and then I almost lost myself. My children almost lost their parent, and I managed somehow to drag myself up from the bottom of the mire, and I know it can be done. It just takes persistence. It takes a willingness. A lot of people, say, oh, I'm not going to take that medication, it has a side effect. And my response to that is, what's worse, a side effect or feeling depressed and suicidal? A side effect you can tolerate. You can't tolerate being suicidal. You'll die. So it's a question of perspective, and it's a question of deciding, you know, that you're going to work at it and not giving in, just saying, I'm going to keep trying one day at a time. I'm just going to keep hanging in there. And when the pain is really acute, as it was for me, which is when I got suicidal, I felt that there was no way out. The pain, which was a mental pain, a physical pain, I just wanted to end everything. And I'm sure that's how my mother felt, and I'm sure that's how other people who are suicidal feel. You just want it to end. And if you can get past that point of wanting it to end, however you do it, whether it's with therapy or meditation or family support, or, you know, people find different ways for themselves, different paths to follow. If you can get past that point of wanting it to end, then you dig down deep and you find a way to climb up that ladder out of the hole. And so, you know, I got healthy, and I know other people who've gotten healthy, and I know that people who are listening can get healthy. You just have to really work at it. It isn't easy, and it isn't given to you. You have to work at it.
All right. 10 minutes left, and I've run out of questions. Is there anything...
Well, it's because I talk so much. There you go. I've scared the questions right out of your mind. Is there anything else I want to say?
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to say that I love being a writer, that I, you know, I grew up thinking that I loved to write, but my mother said, never be a writer. I'll follow you around like an old gray ghost. And that certainly has been true. It's been hard to be the writer in a family, or to be a writer in a family where the writer is so famous, so well known, so beloved, and to kind of follow in these huge footsteps that, you know, you always feel like you should be filling, but somehow, you know, you're never sure you really do. That's why I find it so important to have people write to me and talk to me. I have a website where people can get in touch with me. That is Linda Gray Sexton. So the Gray is with an A, and it's all one word, lindagraysexton.com. There's a contact button. People very often write to me and talk to me about their innermost thoughts, feelings, sadnesses, happinesses, you know, whatever they need to say. I love to listen to people and to know that I'm connecting with them. It's the most enjoyable part of what I do. You know, if you don't have that connection as a writer, then I don't think you're succeeding as a writer. And for my mother, that was certainly true. She just got piles of fan mail. She answered every single piece. If she did it just with a postcard and wrote something short on it with her name and drew a daisy, her signature was trademark was a daisy that she drew by hand. She loved daisies. You know, she really felt it was important to connect. She went, she did readings. She hated doing them, but she loved the way she would touch people's lives. And so she was an example for me of how your writing can matter in the life of somebody else, and that you can get feedback on that that will warm you, make you feel that what you're doing is worthwhile and worthy, that it's worth all the hard work, all the being alone and struggling on your own to be your own boss, and to try and produce something worthwhile when there's nobody to judge but yourself, which is hard. You know, if you're lucky, you get an editor who helps you revise. But you spend most of your time on your own, and that's hard. One of the things I say in my most recent newsletter is that, you know, I went through this period of publicity for Bespotted, and now I'm back to being on my own and writing on my own, and there's such a shift between the public world where the public eye is upon you as you present your latest work, and then the secret world where you create. So they're two very different things. And the publicity part is always really hard for me. The best thing for me is getting feedback from people, either when they come up to me after I give a reading or I do a radio show and I hear back from people, or I just get email through my website. You know, all those things are what matter to me the most. And that's really why I find writing so fulfilling, and I believe it's why my mother found writing so fulfilling. You know, she felt she was giving voice to feelings that a lot of people had, and I feel the same way. I feel like I'm giving voice to feelings a lot of people have, and that makes it 100% worthwhile and a beautiful thing to do. I love it. So I guess that's what I would have to say.
Okay. Well, thank you again for participating tonight. I definitely enjoyed it, as I said, because I've read your books and they've touched me personally. So, so you're definitely one of the people I wanted on this show once I got it started. So,
well, I'm really glad to have been here. It's been a pleasure with your thoughtful questions. I appreciate them, and I hope, you know, your listeners have learned something about what it's like to be a writer and what it's like to climb out of the hole of mental illness, what it's like to put parental examples behind you when they're bad ones, and just, you know, how to go through life with an increasingly positive attitude. So I hope it's been that for people.
All right. Well, I thank you again, and we'll just end the show now.
Okay. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.